Welcome to Curated Conversations from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, bringing you the best events each week from the world's number one defense and national security think tank. To explore the hundreds of events we host each year, visit us at csis.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Kathleen Hicks. I direct the International Security Program here at CSIS, and I want to welcome you to our celebration of NASA's 60th anniversary. We have a hat trick of NASA administrators here, and we're very grateful to our sponsor at Boeing for helping us put together today's event. This afternoon, our keynote address will be delivered by NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. Administrator Bridenstine is NASA's 13th administrator, and he was elected to represent Oklahoma in 2012 in the 1st Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he has just returned back from Oklahoma this morning, so we're grateful that he came back for this event here today. His federal service actually began in the U.S. Navy, where he flew combat missions in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And he also has a degree from Rice University and an MBA from Cornell. Following his keynote address, Todd Harrison, who directs our aerospace security project, will lead a moderated discussion with former Administrator Charlie Bolden and former Administrator and CSIS Senior Advisor Sean O'Keefe. And after all of that, we will invite everyone to join us for some birthday cake to celebrate NASA's 60th anniversary. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Administrator Bridenstine.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kathleen, for that nice introduction. Thank you, John Hamry, for all you do for CSIS. This is an organization that I have a high regard for. The Center for Strategic and International Studies is an important organization that helps us as policymakers make good decisions. I've spoken before this group a number of times as a member of Congress and now as the NASA administrator, and it's an absolute honor to be here in this new capacity in which I serve. I want to start by also letting everybody here know that it's a bit humbling for me to stand before this audience and have in my audience former NASA administrators, Sean O'Keefe and Charlie Bolden, both of whom have served this country very well, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to occupy an office once held by both of you. The shoes are very big, and I'm gonna do the best I can to fill them. So thank you guys for your service as well. So here we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of NASA, and we are doing it at CSIS, where we talk about strategy and the strategic implications for organizations like NASA for the United States of America. So I'll start by going back in time just a bit. How about the year 1915? A lot of people don't realize, but NASA had its start a long time ago under an organization called NACA, the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics. This was started in 1915 as a way to, during World War I, as a way to align academic institutions with industry and government in order to take advantage of aeronautics to ultimately win World War I. That was NACA. And at the time, and just to be clear, in 1915 when it was created, I read this just this morning. I thought it was a bit fascinating. They tried to pass a bill in 1913. They dropped a bill in the House and they dropped a bill in the Senate, identical language, and tried to pass it through Congress in 1913. And it failed. They couldn't get it to pass. A couple of years later, in 1915, they actually shoved it into a naval appropriation bill, which made me think, that's interesting. That's how we do it today. If you're trying to get something passed and you can't get it done as a standalone bill, you shove it into another bill that's guaranteed to pass, and voila, you accomplish the objective, and nobody knew it happened until after it was done. Interestingly, I've had a little experience with that with the American Space Renaissance Act, which I dropped as a comprehensive space reform bill for the United States of America, knowing full well that ultimately had very little chance of passing, but I also knew full well that it would be the repository for the best ideas in space reform, and we could get parts of the bill passed in other pieces of legislation, and we had a lot of success doing that over the course of the last 2 or 3 years. So now as NASA administrator, we're able to affect, you know, a lot of those policies from the executive branch, which is interesting and a great change of venue, if you will, from my perspective. So NACA got its start in 1915. It was the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics. It started with about 100 people, and there were 4 centers across the country. One was Langley, which is still Langley. One was Ames out in California in the San Francisco area, which is still Ames. There was the Lewis Flight Research Center, which of course is now the Glenn Research Center out in Ohio. And then the Armstrong Flight Research Center, which this was even before it was Dryden. At the time, it was called the Muroc Flight Research Center. So these 4 centers composed NACA, and their objective was to ultimately help academia, industry, and government advance aeronautics in ways that otherwise would never happen. And so what they started doing is they started working on airfoils. How do we make wings that ultimately can benefit the United States of America? Eventually, their mission changed. It wasn't just to win World War I, but ultimately to advance aeronautics in the United States, both commercially and militarily. Now, at that time, you can imagine, they weren't using terminology like the offset. You guys are all familiar with the first offset because this is CSIS, and the second offset, and now the third offset, and how many more offsets. They weren't using that language, but ultimately they were trying to create, here's another one that you guys use here at CSIS, the qualitative military edge, qualitative technological edge. That's what they were trying to accomplish, although they didn't use the terms back then. But they started designing airfoils and fairings and these kind of capabilities that ultimately produced aircraft that could really perform much better than they previously had. One particular capability was a fairing over the radial engines. If you remember the big radial engines, you think back to a T-6 Texan, the original Texan, not the Texan II, or you think back to a T-28 Trojan, an F-4U Corsair, those massive radial engines. And they put this fairing on it that was developed by NACA, and all of a sudden it reduced the drag by 60%. And it increased the airflow over the engine and did a whole host of other things that ultimately made the aircraft perform so much better. So those fairings on those kind of big radial engines that you see were developed by NACA and ultimately gave the United States of America an advantage for a good period of time. Eventually, it wasn't just wings and fairings, but you know, they developed wind tunnels and engine test stands, and they developed places to test flight, ultimately resulting in capabilities that did give us a qualitative military edge. When it came to World War II, NACA got very involved in, you know, turbocharging internal combustion engines. If you can imagine, the question was, okay, when you're flying above 15,000 feet, the performance of your engine actually declines. Well, how do we prevent that declination from happening? And the answer was, well, we'll inject additional air. We'll compress air and inject it. And so they created turbocharge. That was done by NACA. And those technologies that enabled us to fly those engines faster and perform higher, ultimately we're not just using the B-17, which was the initial purpose for it, but ultimately used in P-51s and a whole host of other capabilities that gave us an edge in World War II all the way through to the end. And again, it wasn't just, you know, supercharged engines, airfoils. NACA continued to be very involved in airfoils. And in fact, it was Great Britain that wanted a new fighter in order to be more effective in World War II, and they went to North American Aviation and said, we'd like you to develop us a new fighter. And they came up with the P-40 Tomahawk, and Great Britain said, no, we need something that can perform even at a higher level. So then they came to NACA, and the airfoil that they wanted ultimately ended up being the airfoil used by the P-51 Mustang, which, of course, everybody understands was, you know, the superior aircraft at that particular time in history. So these are very strategic capabilities. It's important to understand that at this time, and people didn't always say it, but whoever controls technology ultimately controls the balance of power on the planet. And that was never more true than immediately after World War II. As the war was ending, a lot of people in this room are familiar with the Yalta Conference. It was on Crimea, and you had Franklin Delano Roosevelt there, you had Winston Churchill, and you had Joseph Stalin on Crimea. And they were negotiating, how do we ultimately secure the peace for the long term in Europe? And ended up being, how do we divide Europe between East and West? And ultimately, how do we divide Germany between East and West? And the Russians had lost millions and millions of people in World War II, and so they decided that they wanted the preponderance of the land in Germany, and they claimed this big swath of land in eastern Germany. Well, here's what we learned as the war was concluding, that there was amazing technology in eastern Germany produced at the hands of some of the most ruthless and brutal people in world history, the Nazis. This is a scary thought, but they had advanced capabilities and technologies using human beings as guinea pigs. We're talking about some of the most grotesque ways of testing these very fierce weapon systems. And it's something that we can never allow to happen again. But the reality is these technologies were there. And the question is, who was going to control them? You had things like, chemical warfare, for example. Chemical and biological weapons had been developed and tested on human beings. Of course, everybody is familiar with the concentration camps and the Jewish Holocaust, and we're familiar with some of the most And it wasn't just the Jews, it was others, it was all kinds of prisoners of war from different campaigns across Europe. And at the end, here's the key concern. They had developed technologies that included pressurized cabins for aircraft. And they had developed, of course, chemical and biological weapons, but they had also developed the beginnings of nuclear weapons and low observable submarines. And the ME-262, which was the world's first jet aircraft used for combat, jet fighter aircraft. They had developed the V-2 rocket. Who can forget the V-2 rocket? Or the V-1, which was the world's first cruise missile. V-2 rocket, of course, being ultimately a technology that could, not quite an ICBM, but a short-range ballistic missile that rained terror in Great Britain. And the question was this: with all of these technologies that have been developed, and ultimately we're extremely grateful that the war came to an end when it did, because had those technologies seen the field of battle, some of them could have extended the war a very long time, if not changed its course. So at the Yalta Conference, the leaders of the world got together and they said, okay, well, this part of Eastern Germany is going to belong to the Soviet Union. And that was agreed to with Joseph Stalin present. Well, within weeks, Harry Truman had authorized American soldiers to go into Eastern Germany for one purpose, to acquire all of those capabilities, all of those technologies. Hundreds of cars of trains were sent into East Germany with American soldiers, ultimately to gather up all of the capabilities of the V-2 rockets specifically. Remember, these rockets were built by slave labor. And now they're at risk of falling into the hands of what is the former Soviet Union. And in a dose of realism, the United States of America said, and this is important for CSIS, whoever controls the technology controls the balance of power. And so they went in. After signing an agreement that they wouldn't, they went in, they took as much of that technology as they possibly could, not just the hardware, which they got a whole lot of V-2 rockets and a whole lot of V-1 rockets. Then they went and they asked if the German scientists would like to come to the United States of America and ultimately help us understand the technology and develop it even further. Some of these German technologists ended up being the best rocket scientists in the history of the world, helping us ultimately get to the moon and winning in that Cold War. I want to be clear about this. People say, well, NASA is a peaceful agency, and absolutely it is. We do science, we do technology, we do discovery. That's what NASA is, that's what NASA does, it's what we will always do, and no, we do not get involved in warfare. And I hear all the time people ask me, well, are you going to be the leader of the Space Force? And I'm here to tell you that that's not what NASA is, and that's not what NASA does. But I'm also here to tell you that when we went to the moon, it had a very strategic purpose, and that was to demonstrate that the United States of America has a superior economic, political, and technological capability so that the world would align with us rather than them. That was the purpose of that mission. And what's even more fascinating is 12 years later, after 12 years after the last person walked on the moon, which isn't that long, we had a president announce the Strategic Defense Initiative, which ultimately got, you know, in the media, it was a terrible idea. There's no way it was technologically, you know, we're talking about a missile defense shield, if you will. The Strategic Defense Initiative ultimately was too expensive, the technology wasn't there, it couldn't possibly be done. But here's what we learned. Because we had just walked on the moon, and when we walked on the moon, by the way, we did it six times. 12 human beings walked on the surface of the moon because of what NASA did. The whole world watched it. And because of that, when we announced the Strategic Defense Initiative, people all around the world took note and they said, well, these are the folks that walked on the moon. They can actually accomplish this. So while in the United States they actually called it the Star Wars program to belittle it, and they said it can't possibly be achieved, the people who believed it could be done was the Soviet Union. And they started investing heavily in trying to mitigate against this Strategic Defense Initiative. They went to all of the world conferences trying to prevent it from happening, calling it provocative. And ultimately, because of all their investment, it was just a small piece. And by the way, how much did we really spend on the Strategic Defense Initiative? Very, very little. It never really materialized. We had the brilliant Pebbles program and a few other things. But ultimately, what was the purpose of it? The purpose of it was to force the Soviet Union to the negotiating table. And by the way, here's another important thing to note. Even before all of that happened, when we walked on the moon, who congratulated us first? The Soviet Union congratulated us. Their cosmonauts were calling American astronauts and congratulating them and welcoming them to their country to give speeches at universities and other places. And ultimately, the Apollo-Soyuz program got formed. And so what was a Cold War ultimately ended up with NASA being at the center of a dialogue about the future, about instead of competing with each other and putting people's lives at risk. As we think back, you think Apollo 8 was a tremendously risky mission. But the goal was ultimately to beat the Soviet Union to orbit the moon. And we achieved it at great risk to American astronauts. And after that, the Soviet Union said, well, maybe we ought to reconsider. And instead of competing and putting our cosmonauts and your astronauts at risk, maybe we ought to partner. And eventually that occurred. And Apollo-Soyuz has been a great and remarkable achievement, where you had the two most powerful, you know, superpowers competing against each other, ultimately sitting down at the negotiating table. And here's another thing that's absolutely fascinating. Even today, that relationship that was forged back then continues. And as relationships sometimes devolve, as we have seen, because of world events, ultimately, those devolutions have been protected from applying to space. I'll give you an example. After the invasion and occupation of Crimea, the United States Congress passed a sanctions bill on Russia. Oh, but there was one piece that had to be carved out. and that was space. Why? Because that is our best opportunity to dialogue when everything else falls apart. We've got American astronauts and Russian cosmonauts dependent on each other on the International Space Station, which enables us to ultimately maintain that dialogue. So I would argue that one of the greatest values of NASA as an agency is that it is an amazing soft power tool for the United States of America. So you go back and you look at kind of how the Apollo program ended. It ended with a partnership, the Apollo-Soyuz partnership, which is a very positive development, and that partnership even continues today on the International Space Station. Of course, if you go to Russia, they'll call it the Soyuz-Apollo program, which is understandable. But at the end of the day, that partnership continues, and then the next step was the Strategic Defense Initiative, ultimately, which was built on the credibility of Apollo. So you think about how NASA has impacted the strategic position of the United States of America through history. And you think about all of the different challenges that NASA has gone through, and believe me, we know what they are, and they've been troubling, and the whole world stops when these challenges occur. People, of course, know Challenger and Columbia and Apollo 1. And the whole world stops. But the reality is, here's the question: why do we do this? What is the purpose of it? Did these folks who did these things, did they die in vain? And I'm here to tell you that they didn't die in vain. They died for a very important and specific purpose, which was ultimately to create a world that is freer and safer than it otherwise would have been. And NASA has been at the absolute center of that ever since it was created in 1958 by Dwight Eisenhower. So with that, I just want to say it's an honor to be here. Being at the helm of NASA at its 60th anniversary is a bit humbling. And it's an honor to serve in this capacity. And I look forward to a dialogue up here with my predecessors. And I look forward to hearing kind of some of their thoughts and ideas as well. I want to be really clear. We're here to talk about the 60th anniversary, and there's a lot of history that I've just discussed. Some of it we like, some of it is not so fun to think about. But it's also true that NASA has an amazing future. And I want to be able to talk about that too. And in the coming months, you're going to hear a lot about that. A lot of it is possible because of the trail that was blazed by these folks. It's also true, this is an important point to note as well. You think about the balance of power because of technology, which I know CSIS has on their agenda. You think about, and I've talked about this a lot, and if there's one thing I accomplish in my time as NASA administrator, if I can elevate in the minds of the American public how important space is to their everyday lives and how it's transformed our ultimate ability to do basic things. I'll just give you some examples. The way we navigate. Anybody use GPS? The way we communicate. Anybody use DirecTV or Dish Network or internet broadband from space? Maybe an Iridium phone? Am I allowed to use that? When you think about the way we navigate, the way we communicate, the way we produce food. I was at a swim meet this weekend with my kids. By the way, if I ever get some kind of disease that's going to kill me, I want to go to a swim meet because they last forever. So I was there for 3 days, 14 hours a day. You're waiting around all day to watch a 30-second race. But anyway, where was I? So here I was at the swim meet. I'm sitting next to a gentleman from Nebraska who's got grandkids in the swim meet. And we're strike out. He's like, hey, what do you do? I said, well, I work for NASA. Oh, wow, that's fantastic. What do you do for NASA? Well, I'm the administrator. Well, what does the administrator do? I was like, well, and he starts going into depth about how NASA technology is helping them understand when to plant crops and when to get their crops ready to harvest and understanding the moisture in the soil. He's telling me about how they produce food using NASA technology. And I'm like, that's fantastic. I'm going to go tell people about your story. So the way we produce food in this country. And by the way, there's a lot of people to feed. And in the coming year, there's going to be a lot more people to feed. And NASA technology is going to be able to help produce that food, the way we produce energy in this country, the way we do disaster relief and predict weather. A lot of people in this room have heard me as a member of Congress talk about weather because I come from Oklahoma, and as a member of Congress, I had a lot of constituents get killed in tornadoes, and the technology exists to prevent it from happening. So how do we predict weather better? NASA does that. NASA develops the technologies that ultimately NOAA utilizes to predict weather. How do we understand how the climate is changing? That's what NASA does. When you think about ultimately the way we do disaster relief, the way we do national security and defense, one of the things that I think is most salient is the fact that every GPS or every banking transaction in this country you're required to have a GPS signal for timing for every banking transaction. That means GPS is critical. It's a critical piece of infrastructure for this country. So you think about how important space is to our everyday lives. And I would be willing to argue that most Americans don't know that right now. So if I accomplish one thing as the NASA administrator, that's my objective, is let people understand how critical space is to their everyday lives, how ultimately it has produced so much more than the investment that has been made by the United States government. And it's not just the spin-off technology that a lot of people talk about, Tang and Velcro. Don't get me wrong, those are impressive. And game-changing, as a matter of fact. But there's so much more that people don't always talk about that is critically important. So again, you look at whoever controls the technology controls the balance of power. All of these technologies, NASA isn't involved in all of those technologies directly. GPS is a DoD program. But NASA blazed the trail that made all of it possible. And NASA will continue blazing the trail. And the future that we have at NASA is just as bright as the history that we have at NASA. And again, it's an honor to be here for the 60th anniversary. And I just can't tell you, again, how much I love CSIS. Keep doing what you're doing. Put out those scholarly papers. Help people like me make good decisions, which is what you always do. And I look forward to working with you again. So anyway, thank you guys so much.
Thank you. I'm Todd Harrison, Director of the Aerospace Security Project here at CSIS. And so we're going to go through, and I've got a few prepared questions first, but we also want to hear from all of you. Let's see if I can make the slide change here. So if you've got a question, either those in the room or those watching online, you can go to the website here, type in your question. I'll get it up here on the iPad, and I can work it into the conversation here. So please go ahead and ask any questions that you may have and get them queued up. My first question to you, Administrator Bridenstine. We'll go ahead and get it out of the way. Space Force.
Okay.
Been a lot of talk recently. The president's come out strongly in favor of it. It's been, you know, debated in Congress, and when you were in Congress, it was debated as well. It's something similar to that has passed the House of Representatives, not the Senate. But as NASA administrator, you know, I'm glad that you articulated that, you know, NASA's not part of the Space Force. But what would the relationship be, do you think, between a military Space Force and NASA? And why is it important to maintain that separation between military space and civil space programs?
So that's a wonderful question. You know, when President Eisenhower, his vision for NASA, there was a time before NASA was created when a lot of folks believed that the Department of Defense ultimately ought to be in charge of space development, if you will, space exploration, space development, and of course all the national security provisions of space. President Eisenhower specifically did not want that. He wanted a civilian space agency where all of our friends and even competitors around the world could ultimately partner with us to have an opportunity for dialogue. His vision was very different than some others who wanted NASA, which of course wasn't NASA at the time, but they wanted it to be as part of the Department of Defense. Now, I want to be clear about the Space Force. I support it 100%. I always have supported it. I voted on it 3 times in the House of Representatives. At the time, you mentioned it was a little different. It was called the Space Corps. But what the Space Corps was is very similar, if you will, to what the Space Force the way I see it. Of course, there hasn't been any specifics released on what the Space Force might look like. But from what I've heard the president say, he wants a force that is separate from the Air Force, but equal in stature to the Air Force. That's what he said very clearly at the last National Space Council meeting. And so to me, that means you're talking about a force that has somebody on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for example, a force that has its own service secretary, for example. That's not guaranteed what ultimately might develop here, but that's what it indicates to me. But think about what it is. I mean, the Space Force actually already exists inside the Air Force. So you've got the space, and think all a military service does: organize, train, and equip. That's what a military service does: organize, train, and equip. So you've got Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, organize, train, and equip. Then you've got the combatant commanders that ultimately go and fight the war. And the combatant commands are all joint. They have all four of the branches. So when you talk about a separate space force, there's one piece, which is organizing, training, and equipping a cadre of professionals that can fight a war. That doesn't mean the Space Force is going to go fight the war, necessarily, but it would be a cadre of professionals that are trained, organized, and equipped to do that. And when you think about what's inside the Air Force right now, you got the Space and Missile Systems Center, which of course does the acquisition piece for all of the Air Force's space capabilities. And then you've got Strategic Command. You got the Air Force Space Command that ultimately does the training and organizing. When I say organizing, you're just talking about recruiting the right folks and then training them. So the Air Force Space Command, the Space and Missile Systems Center, kind of are already doing the function of organizing, training, and equipping. Then you've got Strategic Command, which ultimately is the combatant commander that is a joint command. And so Strategic Command could take advantage of those capabilities. So a lot of it already exists. One of the challenges that we see, and the debates that have happened on the Armed Services Committee, is at what level is Air Force leadership paying attention to space? Now, I will tell you, they are paying attention to it. Without question, they are paying attention to it. Has that always been the case? I will tell you, many members of Congress don't think that has always been the case. Will it always be the case in the future? Unknown. But here's what we see. When you look at promotions inside the Air Force, the space cadre doesn't get promoted nearly as much. When you look at retention inside the Air Force, it appears as though maybe the space cadre isn't as well. Maybe they're not. The morale might not be as high. And when you think about the budget levels for the space component of the Air Force, maybe it's not getting as much attention as the other components of the Air Force. So the idea was to create a separate Space Force, equal in stature, but separate from the Air Force, to have an advocate on the Joint Chiefs and a separate service secretary, although that wasn't in our bill. Our bill didn't have it was much like the Marine Corps ultimately reports to the Secretary of the Navy. The Space Corps would report to the Secretary of the Air Force. That's what we did in the Armed Services Committee. And it passed, this is what's amazing, it passed overwhelmingly with a bipartisan vote in both the Strategic Forces Subcommittee, on the Armed Services Committee, and then in the House of Representatives as part of the National Defense Authorization Act. So this is a bill that has passed, in my opinion, given all that I just talked about, how important space is to our everyday lives and the proliferation of the threats. You've got the Chinese are launching direct ascent anti-satellite missiles. The Russians are doing the same. You've got co-orbital anti-satellite capabilities, jamming, spoofing, hacking, dazzling. Dazzling is just using directed energy or laser energy to confuse satellites, sometimes temporarily, sometimes permanently, destroying satellites. All of these technologies are proliferating rampantly as the American people are explicitly dependent on space for national security and just their everyday lives. So in my opinion, it's well past due for to have a standalone force capable of preparing a workforce to ultimately protect our assets in space. Again, I want to be clear, because this is important. This is not what NASA does. But NASA does have billions of dollars worth of your taxpayer dollars at risk because of what's happening in space. And it's not just the hostile actions, it's also space debris and other challenges. And then it's also true that Anyway, I should stop there, but the reality is there's a lot of threats. The United States of America has a lot at stake. NASA has a lot at stake up there, and in fact, even more importantly, we're the only agency that has humans at stake up there, and more space debris ultimately puts all of that at risk. So, you know, I do think it's something whose time has come, and I've supported it as a member of the House of Representatives.
So I want to pick up on human spaceflight there for a minute. So, you know, right now we are, of course, dependent on the Russians and the Soyuz to put our astronauts in space. It's been that way since the shuttle retired in 2011. But our working with the Russians to launch our astronauts has gone back about 23 years. So we pulled the stats here. It looks like we've had 52 American astronauts launched by the Russians. What's interesting is not a single one of them have been African American. None of our African American astronauts have ever been launched by the Russians. And so that means since 2011, no African American astronauts from NASA have been in space, has had the opportunity. That was going to change. This past June, Jeanette Epps was going to be launched. She was on a mission, had trained with the Russians, was going to go up with them. She was pulled from that mission. And I understand, you know, you can't necessarily talk about specific personnel actions, and that happened before you were administrator. But, you know, it does raise the question, what's going on? Are the Russians refusing to launch African-American astronauts?
If that is the case, I have never heard that. Certainly, I will start asking that question now that you've mentioned that to me. But I have not heard that, and I am unaware if that's the case.
And can I add something?
Absolutely.
I think I'm not sure where that conjecture came from, but I think it's absurd. You know, I served as the NASA administrator for 8 years, and one of my biggest partners was a guy with whom I flew, Sergei Krikalev. On the first joint Russian-American shuttle mission. And that mission was set up specifically to be like Apollo Soyuz, to demonstrate that Russians and Americans could in fact work collaboratively in space in anticipation that we might want to send American astronauts to Mir and then subsequently operate on a space station together. So, you know, that was the beginning of it, and I never saw any indication in the whole time I was the NASA administrator from communicating with the head of Roscosmos and cosmonauts themselves that they ever had any problems at all with anybody that we decided we were going to fly.
And when you were an astronaut yourself, Russians flew with you on
yes,
the space shuttle.
Yes.
And you trained with them.
Yes.
And you never experienced problems?
No. Okay. More problems here than there.
I don't know if that's good to hear or not.
It's American history.
Yes. So, you know, next question, I want to, you know, go down and hear from each of you on this. You know, obviously, in your remarks, Administrator Bridenstine, you talked about how NASA has played an important role in U.S. foreign policy and diplomacy. And, you know, we've maintained this coalition on the International Space Station for many years. You know, for you, what do you think that coalition is going to be in the future? How's it going to evolve? Are we going to add partners? Do you think we'll drop partners? How do you think that's going to evolve for the space station and for plans for going back to the moon?
I think we're going to add partners, and I think it, you know, what we're in the process of right now is developing an architecture that's very open for our return to the moon, starting with the Gateway. And so all of the interfaces, whether you're talking about docking interfaces or electrical power, all of the interfaces are going to be standardized, they're going to be published, everybody's going to see it. And then it's going to enable a whole host of countries that maybe don't have an agency with our level of budget, but they can maybe create a small lander that ultimately could, a robotic lander, if you will, that could interface with an open architecture gateway around the moon. When I say gateway, I'm talking about a small outpost around the moon capable of human habitation, power and propulsion, able to go more places around the moon than ever before with human beings. But the idea is to create an open architecture where all of our commercial partners can join and international partners can join. And in fact, partners can join that historically have not had access because it's going to be that easy. If they want to have a space program and ultimately participate, we want to be able to find a way for them to do that. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, but we want it to be the most collaborative international kind of program in history, and I think we can accomplish that.
So, Mr. O'Keefe, your time at NASA, what were your experiences trying to maintain that international partnership on the space station? Was it worth it?
Absolutely. It was a challenge, no question about that. In fact, like Charlie and I were talking and comparing notes a little bit on the respective issues to be encountered in dealing with all of the international partners working through it. But in many respects, just like Jim said, I think as a fundamental part of the history of NASA, it has been a great convener of capabilities not only around the world, but among and between what used to be and can be adversaries, then finding common space and common position and common interest in trying to develop that in a more collaborative manner as a global enterprise. So it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort trying to find that common position that can be then developed for mutual advantage from each of the players involved is an enormous amount of effort. You feel like you're in binding arbitration and negotiating every element of what's involved. But it's worth it because you then at least create the opportunity for that common dialogue and reduce the tensions, just as Jim said, I think very powerfully, I think in your opening comments, Jim, of how this has played a very effective role at really kind of lowering the temperature level in any number of different adversarial conditions over the course of the last several decades. And that's a huge achievement. NASA's not the foreign policy development activity, nor is it the only technology development by any means activity. But it is a place in which it reaches common interest and can be sorted to what become mutual advantage and mutual gain, if done properly. And that's always a risk. I mean, one of the things that Charlie and I were talking about was that you have to always avoid the issue that the U.S. is simply setting a position and forcing everybody else to come along. This is something that really takes a lot more effort in that regard, and certainly we're seeing the very effort of that mutual collaboration, mutual dependency, at play today, every single day, mm-hmm. on a remarkable capability that has been operational now for 18 years, continuously, with folks from all manageable, all the imaginable partners that have been engaged in the International Space Station Coalition, working together collaboratively in order to achieve a gain that we would never have agreed or found a way to understand and then agree to otherwise. And so it's been a remarkable achievement in that regard, but one that, again, takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of time, and it worked through an awful lot of differences of opinion.
And so, General Bolden, you were NASA administrator when the relationship with Russia overall started to deteriorate after Ukraine, Crimea, and somehow it held together when it came to the ISS. The partnership with Russia held together. So what were your experiences and what can you take away from that? The fact that we were able to continue to engage with Russia in one area while we had a lot of disagreements in other areas.
I think I would agree with one thing that the administrator said, and that was how humbling it is to sit in that office. The one thing that I think the three of us hopefully have an appreciation of is that when you go to an international forum, there is no question who is the person to whom everybody looks. It's the NASA administrator. With the International Space Station, we tried to meet quarterly with the member organizations, all five of us, and there was never a question of who was going to sit at the head of the table and who was going to set the agenda and who was going to essentially make sure that the meeting flowed well. It was the NASA administrator. And Jim mentioned the term soft power. I'm a little bit stronger than he was when you talk about soft power. I think, and with all deference to the State Department and the Department of Defense, they're all good. One of the strongest purveyors of soft power for this nation is NASA. Mm-hmm. And it is, if you want an example of it, it is in fact the sustainability of the International Space Station over the last 17, 18 years, in spite of everything else that goes on down here on the planet. And one of the reasons is because everybody's focused on a mission. Yep. Everybody realizes that it's a team and that no one element survives without the other elements. When we have problems in the Russian segment with waste management, you know, you run over and you get something out of the U.S. segment, or everybody runs into the U.S. segment to do normal kinds of things that are necessary for human beings to survive. And that may seem trivial.
I picked that example.
I picked that example because kids, the first things kids always ask used to be, how do you go to the bathroom in space? And there are only two places to go to the bathroom in space. You can go in the U.S. segment, or you can go in the Russian segment. And they don't always work all together. But always one of them is working. And I'm not trying to make light of anything, but I just want to reemphasize what Jim said about the critical importance of sustaining the partnerships and expanding them whenever we can. You know, one of the things that we started doing in the last few years, and Tom Crimmins is sitting here in the front row, who was one of the architects, is every time we went to an international forum, opening it to everybody and saying, station was one way to do things. We're getting ready to go explore now, and there are nations that didn't even have a space program when the International Space Station program started. So we invited everybody to the table, and we could have 25 nations, some of whom didn't even have a space program, but wanted to be at the table, giving their ideas and sharing their ideas on what we do when it comes to exploring. What will we do when we go beyond low Earth orbit, because we want to be there. We can't build a rocket ship, but we can do some other things, and I think that's critically important.
To piggyback on what Charlie was just talking about, how the whole world, all the different space agencies from around the world, they're all looking one direction. Mm-hmm. I just got back, I did a trip to Israel and then a trip to the Farnborough Air Show, where all of the different space agencies in Europe were represented. Met with a whole host of them, one-on-ones, and then of course in groups as well. And it was astonishing to me how a lot of them were saying, tell us what you need,
yeah,
we're ready to go, and we'll go sell it. Yeah. We'll get our governments behind it. Yeah. But tell us where you are. And of course, I was going expecting I was going to have to do a hard sell. They're ready. They're just looking for, you know, Americans to say, this is what we need to do, and they'll pull the trigger. So I think, of course, that's all there because of the history here, because they know what we've been able to achieve in the past, and they want to be a part of it in the future. Speaking of what we've been able to achieve in the past, Sean O'Keefe, of course, was at the helm at a time when the International Space Station was at great risk of being canceled. And I want to be really clear. There was a Pew Research poll that came out not too long ago. Many people in this room probably saw it. But one of the questions in the Pew Research poll was, The specific question was the International Space Station a good investment for the United States of America? That was the question. Over 80% of the respondents said yes, the International Space Station was a good investment for the United States of America. That, you know, I come from the political realm. You don't get 80% of people to agree on anything ever. You can say the sky is blue and you're not going to find 80% agree. But they agree that the International Space Station is a good investment. That just shows you the impact that it's had. And of course, there was a time when, you know, Sean was going through his confirmation process. I watched it because I went through a confirmation process of my own. I don't know if you guys are aware of that. But I watched his confirmation process, and I was astonished at the challenges that were happening at the time. And ultimately, here's what's so wonderful. It came down, was it one vote that ultimately came down to?
One vote.
Single vote in Congress that allowed the International Space Station to go forward. And now you've got 80% of Americans saying it was a good investment. That shows you how NASA is different than probably every other government agency you can imagine. So it's all good.
So I want to go to some questions here from the audience. So one related to soft power. The question is, when China seems to have similar plans to use space exploration as a means of soft power. How does NASA kind of maintain the leadership role here and engage other countries, international partners, and private sector partners in its plans to return to the moon? What are your thoughts? Start with you.
So I think the big thing is to get everybody engaged is ultimately to accomplish stunning achievements. I mean, that's kind of how NASA has led in the past. It's how NASA will lead in the future. Again, like I mentioned, the President's Space Policy Directive 1 takes us back to the moon, and he wants it to be done sustainably. He said sustainably. How do you create an architecture that takes us back to the moon sustainably? We are all in awe of Apollo. What an amazing accomplishment. But when it was over, it was over. And the president wants it to be sustainable. In other words, we're going to go back to the moon, and this time we're going to stay. How do you accomplish that given our budget? And I want to be clear, he's been very generous with his budget requests, and Congress has been even more generous on top of his budget requests. So NASA's in a really good shape right now as far as the budget goes. But to be sustainable, we need to take all of our international partners with us, and we need to take our commercial partners with us. So that means it has to be an open architecture, and it starts with landers that are small that can get us to the surface quickly, and then it moves to medium class landers and then large landers that can take humans to the surface of the moon, all being able to integrate with a gateway, if you will, we should say an outpost around the moon. And why is this important? What we've learned from commercial industry is that if rockets are reusable, the cost of access to space goes way down. And we're learning that more and more every day, and we're very grateful for it. And there's more companies now developing reusable capabilities. That is great for our country, it's great for the world. We need the entire architecture between here and the moon to be reusable. That's what Gateway enables us to do. We need landers to be reused potentially dozens of times to go back and forth to the Gateway. And whatever they pick up from the surface of the moon can be, you have scientists at the Gateway that can ultimately, check out what they're picking up from the surface of the moon. This is also important. From 1969 up until 2008, 2009, those 40 years, we believed that the moon was bone dry because of where we went. We went to 6 spots on the surface of the moon, all of, the equatorial regions. In 2008, the Indians made a discovery. In 2009, NASA doubled down on it. There's hundreds of billions of tons of water ice at the poles of the moon. And the question is, how did we not know that for 40 years? And how did it not change the trajectory that we were headed? Ultimately, it's because we only went to certain spots. It would be like studying the Earth and landing in, the Middle East and trying to deduce something about Colorado. It wouldn't work. There's so much more about the moon that we don't yet know, and there's so much opportunity to discover there, that we want to go to more parts of the moon than we've ever gone to before with a sustainable architecture where we can get back and forth on a regular basis, not just with humans, but also with robots. And then ultimately, all of that architecture would feed forward. It would all perfectly replicate itself for a Mars mission. So we're continuing, if you will, the journey to Mars. And I think it's important that that we do that. That's how we bring in our international partners and commercial partners.
And General Bolton, one of your achievements when you were NASA administrator was a commercial cargo and crew program, and bringing in these private sector partners and getting them into the game with NASA. Companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, they've got their own plans to build space infrastructure, and even some of the companies are talking about going to the moon on their own. One of the questions from the audience here is, how do you see NASA working with these private sector organizations to coordinate and to leverage what they're doing to help advance NASA's exploration goals?
Yeah, I wish I could take credit for having done something with commercial crew and cargo, but it started a couple of administrations before us, actually. We just facilitated it, and I think that's the magic word. NASA's job is to facilitate the success of the commercial entities. We found a vehicle called Space Act Agreements, which is a type of a contract, but it's a contract that's much more flexible to the commercial entities, so that's the way we chose to do business with the commercial entities up front. We said, okay, we're going to tell you what kind of service we want, and then it's up to you to design and build proposed to us the type of vehicle to do that. And I love to give people my best example of the wisdom of that. And again, it did not start in the Obama administration. It's like most things with space, it's a continuum. You know, what Jim is doing is stuff that, you know, Sean started, to be quite honest.
I take full credit.
One of the things, well, in fact, one of the things I told him, I said, look, you only get to be the NASA administrator for a brief period of time. Take credit for everything that happens on your
That's
watch.
That's right, he did say that.
Because you're the guy that made it happen. You're the person who allowed it to happen. But facilitating the success of the commercial entities is one of the duties of NASA. And we took that seriously. And so you try to find ways for NASA to be flexible in the way that we do business, to adopt some of the practices and policies that the civilian entities, you know, recommend to you. And that was what I think made us so successful. I was gonna say, if you wanted the best example I can give you of the value of the system that we put in place was, we lost back-to-back-to-back commercial vehicles in less than a year's period of time. When we lost a SpaceX Dragon, we lost an orbital ATK vehicle off the pad, and then we lost the Soyuz cargo vehicle. We were kind of stunned for a while, but we had our European partners to lay back on with an ATV. We had the Japanese with the HTV. So we still had capabilities to get cargo to the International Space Station and sustain the crew. So it's facilitating the success of the commercial partners, working to open the door to enable as many international partners who want to be a part of the, I call them the family of spacefaring nations, finding non-traditional partners, the kind that Jim visited. You know, Israel's a great partner of ours in a lot of things. Israel is not a big space nation, but they are one of the nations that we would call, you know, a non-traditional partner. They're providing something for Orion that's going to be a device to mitigate the radiation effects on a crew member. That's a really big deal from a country that really doesn't have a big, powerful space agency or space program like some of the other countries do. So that's our role.
Yeah, just to add to this too, I think the punctuation point that those of my friends here have enunciated is that, by and large, when you really look at all the different elements of technologies and capabilities and so forth that are emerging, yes, some of them come from federally sponsored agencies, departments, et cetera, laboratories over the course of history, but an awful lot else has come from a wide range of commercial sources. And it's what is common, though, about every one of those circumstances, whether it's defense, whether it's NASA, whether it's any other organization that really relies upon the available commercial technology that is out there that can be leveraged to a different gain, is to establish the mission objectives, the imperative for what you're attempting to use it for. What is the problem you're trying to overcome? And that is one of the most remarkable elements, I think, that's embodied in the 1958 Act of what the primary objective of NASA is supposed to be. And that is really to explore, to develop capabilities that will overcome limitations to get to something else you want to do. And in that, you've got to marshal resources, some of which are organic, progressively less and less within the government, as this has really moved off much more to a commercial capacity. But it is primarily for the purpose of trying to look at what is the limitation of getting to that next capability, that next capacity, where you need to go, where you need to achieve the next outcome. And that is what NASA is able to crystallize in the statement of, here is a capability we're looking for. And with that comes some enormous achievements and successes and some unbelievably tragic failures. Mm-hmm. And those are accompanied, I think, in every case, those bookends, by the fact that no one else has ever attempted to try to leverage it to those kind of levels. And that requires not just collaboration with commercial capabilities, but also with international partners, the broader capabilities, wherever it resides and how you find that solution, that's what you're looking for to try to harness, marshal, hopefully lead, and then develop that capability for that great game.
talking, I just want to raise one point, and it's because we always tend to drift into conversations about human spaceflight. NASA is a big organization that does a lot of things. They have four relatively nice-sized directorates, and the lesser directorates, if you will, in money only. Aeronautics is our heritage, and that is where some of the incredible developments today are going on inside NASA. When you talk about, I mean, we've now got two recognized X-planes. It's been decades since we did that. One, you know, the Quest, the supersonic, low-boom supersonic aircraft, and then an all-electric airplane in Maxwell. Science, we lead the world when you talk about Earth science, heliophysics, planetary science, you name it. And that is where everybody looks to us. And that's where we also have unbelievable international, unlikely international partnerships. The partnerships with the Chinese, whether you're talking about planetary science or geodetics, looking at earthquakes, looking at glacial characterization of the Himalayas, those are areas where scientists of the world who could care less what nation you come from. They've got to focus on solving really tough problems to make the world a better place to be. And NASA provides the, you know, through their science mission directorate, provides just a great place for everybody to be able to come and assemble and take a look at those kinds of things.
That's a great point. I want to ask each of you your thoughts on the future plans for the International Space Station. So the current plan, retirement around 2024, but trying to hand it over to commercial partners, operators who can take it over and do work there. So Administrator Bridenstine, you know, do you think the International Space Station needs more time to make that transition, or do you think it can make it by 2024? And what happens if it doesn't?
Well, we're going to find out. And when I say we're going to find out, what I mean is we put out requests for information from industry as to ultimately 7 years from now, would you be able to a consortium of private companies, would you be able to manage it in a way that would be, you know, cost effective and, you know, close your business case, provide the right return on investment? Now, I don't know what the answer will be from what we get back from that. It might be different than what we're hoping for. I honestly don't know. But I'll tell you, here's the I think the most important thing to take away from it. You know, we had a period of time when, you know, Apollo ended, and we had 8 years before the launch of the first space shuttle. And we had a period of time when the space shuttles ended, and we're right now on the precipice of being able to launch commercial crew. What we don't want is another gap. We want to do everything possible to mitigate that gap. So the question is, how do we do that? We know that the International Space Station cannot last forever. It is a physical impossibility. Can we extend it? Sure, we can extend it. But what we're doing right now is we're forcing a conversation as early as possible to say, if we want to have humans in low Earth orbit forever, you know, think about people graduating from high school right now. People graduating from high school, they have had somebody in space the entire time they've been alive. Mm-hmm. Multiple people in space the entire time they've been alive. That's a big accomplishment, and we don't want it to go away. And in fact, we want to grow the number of people in space, not shrink it. So the question is, how do we get there? The other thing is, you know, NASA has been plowing a ton of money into human activity in low Earth orbit for 20 years. The question is, can we go further? Is it now time to go further? Have we learned sufficiently what we need to learn to go further? And the answer is probably not. But if NASA can be one customer of many customers for a commercial capability, whether it's the International Space Station or some other habitation capability that would be done commercially, or multiple habitation capabilities provided commercially, where the government, and in fact NASA, is one customer of many customers, and the other customers could be manufacturing, could be medicine. You know, they're doing 3D printing now of you know, biological components. Think about organs being printed in space because of the microgravity environment that enables that to be possible. So these capabilities are developing right now very, very fast. And 7 years from now, is it going to be possible to have commercial industry carry that forward so that we maintain a presence in low Earth orbit and at the same time use government resources to go further than we currently can go? And that's ultimately, that's the objective. Now we're going to see what industry proposes. But ultimately, I think 7 years is quite a long time, mm-hmm. as fast as technology is developing right now. And I do believe that low Earth orbit can be commercialized, where the government is one customer of many. There are multiple providers, each competing on cost and each competing on innovation. And I think that's ultimately what will give us the best results.
So, Sean, what are your thoughts? Should we stick with 2024 or extend it?
I think the argument Jim advances over avoidance of a real gap between these kind of circumstances where we're able to operate together, continually learn something, et cetera, is a real risk. It's a real hard time. We've learned from it now. Gosh, you know, we keep repeating the same instances in which we've discovered that reality and that logic. But the added one, I think, that goes to this and the logic behind continuing an effort like this is, in many ways, and again, you know, there's a number of different arguments that can be posed from a scientific, engineering, et cetera, on both sides of this argument as to whether or not it can be sustained, what it should be, whether there's a better platform, a better approach. But in the meantime, you've got this ability that keeps, it's a convening capacity to keep exploring, keep turning over different ideas on how to use capabilities and infrastructure to the next gain, which defines then what the limits are, and then in turn informs what you need to do as a succeeding opportunity, as opposed to constantly starting with a blank sheet of paper every time there's been one of these kind of gaps. And then the last point, I think, is the one that has been repeated several times in the course of this discussion, is just the amazing ability to keep a focused objective on the part of several different international, global partners, players engaged in this capacity is a means to then keep discussing a dialogue over broader gain. And it's hard. I mean, there's no discounting this. This kind of combination of collaboration between different nation states with differing objectives and very different views and so forth is a really difficult challenge. And you spend a lot of time working through it. But it's always too great gain. It's always too advantage. And you're also in the process settling differences on a wider range of other issues that you never anticipated because you've had the opportunity and a reason to define how do I deal with this limitation, overcome it, and get on to the next thing together rather than each of us all going out there and everybody's going out for a pass. You know, it just doesn't work that way. You've really got to leverage this in a way that's important.
So, General Bolden, what are your thoughts?
I'm Charlie. You did that twice.
I'm Sean, you're General Bolden.
I really like that title.
Military sighting. You know?
Yeah, I haven't been a general for a long time.
Two stars is a lot more than I ever had.
I apologize.
What was that? Wait, Charlie.
what are your thoughts, though, on 2024 and, you know, Can NASA push forward with a new space exploration agenda while still sustaining the space?
I'm going to take a different station. Fairness here, we talked a little bit about this before we came in, so I'm going to take a little bit of different tack because I am again, I refer everybody to Tom Crimmins, who was my brain when I was there, and I'm glad to see Jim still have him at least alongside him there.
No, he served that capacity.
Yeah, he has served that capacity. This is three of us who have relied on him now. One of the stipulations that we made in the last few fora that we had internationally with all these nations that want to be a part of the exploration program is we do not want to have a gap. We cannot tolerate a gap. And while we all recognize the fact that the sooner we can get off the International Space Station as something that the U.S. has to be the primary partner for, the better. But we're not coming off station with nowhere to go. And that's why when Jim talks about the gateway and everything else, it is really critical for NASA to facilitate the success of commercial entities to take over, if you will. A lot of people don't like that word, but take over low Earth orbit and let NASA be a customer. Let us be one of many. And then for NASA to do what it does so well, be the leader in lunar orbit, until commercial entities and entrepreneurial entities can migrate there with us. But we do not want to not have humans in lunar orbit whenever that day comes that the International Space Station goes away, because it's over. We cannot tolerate another big gap like that, and that's why I'm a Mars guy. I see Buzz sitting here in the front row. Buzz and I are both Mars guys, and I happen to be one who thinks you could skip the moon, but who cares? We need to do it all, but we've got to. I like being the guy at the head of the table. I like the U.S. being the person at the head of the table, and if you're not there inviting other people to come along with you, you're not at the head of the table. And when we talk about other nations, whether they're adversaries or whatever, Jim hinted at this. You know, we provided for the world an set of international docking standards. So anybody who wants to go to the International Space Station or anything else in space today can use the international docking standards that he made available. That's anybody. And they're available. You can go online and get them. I mean, it's not secret, it's not private, it's not anything. And it says you build your spacecraft by these standards, you can probably qualify to dock to the International Space Station. So I want them docking on a U.S.-led place rather than somebody else's led place. That's just kind of one little thing, a quirk.
So. Administrator Bridenstine, I want to go to you with a question from the audience.
Jim.
Okay. Yeah. All right, we'll all go first all names right. here.
Sure.
This is a question from the audience here. This is a tough one. Get ready. What's your view of repealing the law that prohibits meaningful China-U.S. cooperation in space exploration and science?
So it's interesting. I don't know that it would necessarily require a repeal because it's done an appropriation bill annually. It's the Wolf Amendment, and so you just don't have to put it in the next CJS appropriations bill, if I'm thinking about it right. Yeah. Is that right?
Let me ask a question here because I appreciate the question. The prohibition is not against collaboration in science. The prohibition is against collaboration in human spaceflight.
That's correct.
Because, right. You know, we work cooperatively in aeronautics and air traffic management and science and geodetics and global characterization of glaciers and all kinds of stuff. Well, that was the last thing that Congressman Wolf did before he left the Congress was he softened the language and said, come to the Congress, let us know what you want to do, tell us who's going to be there by name, and guarantee through all the intelligence agencies that you're not going to have any bad actors at the table, mainly for human rights violations. Mm-hmm. That was his passion. And so
that's exactly right. In fact, we just sent a letter over to Congress indicating that I'm going to be meeting with some Chinese space folks over at IAC in Bremen, Germany.
Good.
We're going to have that dialogue because, as Charlie said, we do have partnerships already. The challenge is going forward. Of course, the law that we have to follow, which is critically important, and then there's also a whole host of other challenges that we have with China, to include the theft of intellectual property, and as Charlie mentioned, you know, human rights challenges, and a whole host of other things. Certainly, to the extent that a deal can be hatched that ultimately puts other things on the table, if it enables NASA to partner with China in a way that doesn't ultimately challenge our own national security, then I would be for that. But I think that deal is going to be well above my pay grade, and it would include things that it could include direct ascent to anti-satellite missiles. It could include the air defense identification zone over the Senkaku Islands. It could include building islands in the South China Sea. All of these things are outside the realm of the NASA administrator, and I'm thrilled about that.
Grateful.
Yeah. But I would imagine that to the extent that it changes, it would be inclusive of a number of other things. So.
Okay. Well, and so, Sean and Charlie, if you want to chime in, what are your thoughts? And should we be trying to cooperate more with China on human spaceflight, and particularly plans going back to the moon? Should we try to bring them in as a partner?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable, in part because you've already created an open source system as it is. As Charlie said, you've got any capacity right now, you can research online and don't have to break through anything. Right there on the NASA website, you can find out all manner of different things of what kind of characteristics, positioning, specifications you have to be able to dock on the International Space Station, do almost anything. So this is, again, part of the wisdom of the 1958 Act was to make this capacity to leverage knowledge, technology, investments that are made by the government, by the people of the United States, to greater gain for anybody in order to get to that next solution set. And so it's by definition available for open source. I mean, in all the years I spent in the Pentagon previously, it's exactly the reverse. You're attempting to protect the information in a way because of the nature of its sensitivity. The exact opposite is the charter and mandate of what NASA does to make it available ubiquitously as a means for anybody to do so. And in that regard, the linkage to the question, Todd, I think is very clear that yes, this is a partner that does have a international reputation for trying to derive information from all manner of sources. No question about that. That said, they can avail themselves of it now. Might as well be working with folks to common objective rather than to be constantly competing for the purpose of something as basic as how do you access what's already commonly available anyway. And then that means I think we then have, again, the same way we did with Apollo Soyuz, et cetera, moving through each of these individual intervals of time, a common reference point and mission objective and understanding exactly where each other are coming from with all the advantages and limitations of that, far better than constantly being on opposite sides of an equation and attempting to artificially limit something that fundamentally is impossible to do. No technology discriminates over its ultimate application. We discriminate over it. Individuals, people, nation states, etc. The technology doesn't care. It can be in any circumstance you want to use it for. And how you control that and how you then in turn apply it to leverage gain is the best example of how that can be done. Far better to do it together than to do it in a way that encourages lots of adversarial condition or otherwise. So I would be I have always been an advocate of saying far better to bring everybody in the tent than not.
I spent 34 years on active duty as a Marine, and what I learned as a Marine almost cost me my job as the NASA administrator in year one. I have not changed my mind. I think engagement is absolutely essential. I think that our system of government and our democracy is the strongest thing in the world, and I have not met anybody yet that doesn't, if they spend enough time with me or with us, doesn't recognize the fact that what we have is something that everybody else wants, and you can't get them to believe that if you don't allow them to at least see what's going on. Sean mentioned the military. Ironically, among the most open when it comes to the tent is the military, because we want people to know, sure. You do not want to come entangle with me. So I will let you inside my tent, and I will let you see the kind of things that we can do, but we can do them together, yeah. Or we can go the other route, and none of us wants to go the other route. So I'm a strong advocate for engagement, which means bringing everybody in that wants to be in and watch them and, kind of monitor what they do the way that I think we handle our relationships with everybody right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One final question down the line. I want to ask the two former NASA administrators, looking back on your time at NASA, what was just one of the hard things that you had to do as administrator, and reflecting back on it now?
The most concise answer I've ever been able to come up with on what is a regular question in these cases is I discovered and realized in fairly short order in the privilege and the honor, as these guys have also reiterated, of being in that capacity is, again, the highs are really high and the lows are really low. And there's not a hell of a lot in between. Other than, and with all due respect, sir, testifying before Congress. Mm. That was always the same. You know? I mean, it was
that never, a high or a low?
I'll leave it at that. You know? But it was a circumstance where you have to really adapt to both ends of that equation. And trying to work through with an extraordinary group of amazing professionals that are incredibly gifted people in the expertise of every discipline you can imagine. Any problem you got, you can assemble folks to find a solution to something that is just an imponderable problem that you have. But having everybody focus on how do you get to that objective, and oh, by the way, avoid the highs and avoid the lows, you know, in the extremes, and how do you find how to move everybody through both ends of that equation towards those common objectives and resustain, reemploy, rededicate themselves to that next solution. That's what got us, you know, to the achievements that Buzz Aldrin and his two colleagues were able to attain, because everybody kept their eye on the objective. During times that were really tough in some circumstances, and times that were really celebratory, but it always stayed the same. Here's the real goal. Let's not get distracted from the objective. And that was a challenge given the extremes in those cases, and also, I think, just the nature of how sometimes those tragedies and successes can in turn then motivate people to look in different directions of how you ought to revise what that mission ought to be or what that objective ought to be. And yet go through that debate and discussion in a way that then resolves it and moves on, rather than continually debating where our differences are.
Charlie?
I'm not sure whether this will answer your question, but I share it with people because it's really important. I was the worst, the absolute worst administrator the agency could have ever had in my first 2 years. I was lousy. And because I did not understand Washington, I did not understand, you know, the politics, the system, and everything else. And it was not until, you know, I got through that first 2 years of being the rogue administrator that I recognized the fact that, okay, what did I believe in? And why did I come? Why did I let the president talk me into doing something that my wife said, do not go to Washington because he's gonna ask you to do something and you don't know how to say no. I really believe in the agency, and most importantly, I love the people. And so once I realized that my job was to take care of the people and they would take care of everything else, it became the best job, one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. I cannot say enough for the workforce and the people that just made every single day really special. Yeah. You know, driving up I live down in Mount Vernon, and driving up the GW Parkway every morning, worrying about what kind of day it was gonna be, knowing it could be a really bad day. But every single day that I went home for, you know, the last 6 years, I just said, boy, did we really make a difference today. Yeah. And I think that was for me, the biggest thing, was just being around the greatest group of people in the world next to Marines.
Yeah. Exactly. Jim, I want to give the last word to you. Looking forward, you know, you got 60 years of, you know, history behind you in NASA. What are you most excited about coming in the future?
Well, there's anything I say right now is going to get me in trouble with somebody else, right?
So, what are some of the things you're excited about?
Right. So, I really think that, you know, what we're seeing right now is kind of for the first time in a long time, increasing budgets at NASA. The president's budget request has been strong. Congress has been increasing it from there. The president is calling for us to do big things, going back to the moon, onto Mars, creating this sustainable architecture that includes commercial and international. There's no shortage of exciting things. As far as the challenges go, we have to be really clear about what commercial industry brings to the table, and ultimately what NASA is currently doing brings to the table. One of the foundational things that I should say, one of the fundamental challenges that I think I'm going to face over my tenure at NASA is, should government do this or should government buy it as a service? And on any given issue, there's no one right answer. There are capabilities right now that we need to develop, and there are capabilities right now that exist and we need to purchase as a service. But I am very excited about seeing how ultimately all of it develops in a way that enables the United States of America and our international partners to do more than we've ever done because of the new capabilities that are coming online. I think what we have to be really careful of is not allowing it to become political or partisan, that, oh, this person is for commercial and this person is for traditional. And I want to be clear, our traditional partners are acting more commercial than probably ever in history, and our commercial partners are having to figure out how to meet NASA requirements in ways they've never had to figure out before. So there's this massive blending, I think, that's happening where ultimately NASA is trying to figure out what is the right way to acquire, you know, the capability that we need right now. And I think it's destructive to our country to try to pit one against the other and create these fights. Of course, I understand industry is all, they're always trying to win for themselves, and that's an important part of the American culture as well, and we like that because it makes them compete. But at the same time, trying to make that a reality without turning it into a, well, he's this guy and she's that, you know, way, and that is not in the long term going to be good for our country. So that's going to be a challenge, I think, that I have going forward. But I am also excited about the fact that if managed correctly, we're going to be able to do more than we've ever done before as a country, and we're going to be able to do it with all of our international partners and non-traditional international partners. You mentioned Israel, which of course I mentioned earlier. They've got a commercial company right now raising money privately that's going to the moon. They're launching in December to the moon for a small lander, and they're going to be landing in February. That's one of the reasons it was important for me to go to Israel. Okay, how are you doing this? What are you doing? And is there a way that NASA can take advantage of it and bring them on board with a future architecture for our lunar activities? So, and that's just one country. You look at some of the other countries that have never had space agencies before that now have space agencies. United Arab Emirates, for example, they've got a mission to Mars right now for all you know, for a country with 1 million people and 9 million immigrants, that's an amazing capability that they've developed. And of course, they want to have a big partnership with the United States. They want to have an astronaut program. There is no shortage of opportunities in the future because of what's happening, the transformational capabilities that have just come about probably in the last 10 years because of the trail that these gentlemen have blazed and others, so many others. If managed correctly, the future is very, very exciting for a whole host of capabilities.
All right. Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us here today. It's been a great discussion. We're going to have some, I don't know if we actually got the cake. We heard that there was a problem with the bakery earlier. So we'll see what we've got out there to celebrate the birthday. But please join me in thanking three administrator and former administrators for joining us. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another curated conversation from CSIS. Tune in next week for more, and remember, you can explore all of our events online at csis.org.